We are talking with Danny Vendramini about Them and Us, Neanderthal predation theory. Very, very, very interesting aspect. New aspect, I think, to a lot of people who haven't maybe thought about this before. I wanted to ask you a little bit, Danny, how this has been, how your theory pretty much have been received by, you know, the scientific field, academics, etc. I've read a little bit about it, and it seems like you've been heavily criticized. Why is that, do you think?
I haven't actually been criticized by scientists. I've been criticized a lot by things on the net sometimes by people. What do you call the word for them? People on the YouTube and stuff who write very strange things. And it was interesting. There was one guy who basically said I was a kind of crazy guy. And then at the end of his thing, he says, "I'm only 14, and even I know that you're an idiot." And so I actually wrote to him and said, "Look, you know, this kid wanted to be a scientist." And he said, I made the point that, you know, if he wanted to be a scientist, perhaps he should read the book or something before he started shooting off lots of criticism. And he wrote back and said, "All right, I'm sorry, I should have." But the reaction from scientists, it's interesting, has been very favorable with a couple of bad exceptions, and that's not surprising. One of the things, if you're doing a theory like me, you really need to be aware of the history and the sociology of science, because it tells you what happens to radical new scientific ideas. You basically have to expect that there's certain things are going to happen. First, you're going to be criticized, then you're going to be ignored, then you're going to be it's going to be denied, and then it's not till often 20 years later that you get an impartial assessment. And in fact, even when Darwin, in his book, wrote at the end of it that he didn't expect naturalists who'd been subscribing to different ideas all their working lives and who'd taught different ideas all their working lives to suddenly accept his ideas. And he said he would have to wait for the next generation of young naturalists to view his theory objectively. And I think that that's partly the case here, that I can't expect, realistically, scientists who have spent their whole lives teaching and researching a completely opposite theory to mine to suddenly change ships. For example, there are some scientists in America who take the view that Neanderthals looked like us, they intermarried with us, or they were friends, we traded with each other, that we saw each other's humanity.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very anthropomorphic thing, and this is a kind of something that affects all the life scientists, I think, sciences. It's something we have to, as scientists, you have to be very, very aware of and constantly alert to, that we're not anthropomorphizing, we're not projecting our own humanity onto other species or other creatures.
Well, let me ask you about that, how we can know what the soft tissue really looked like. We have, you know, skeletal remains, of course, but there's, if we look at some of the most common depictions, they're almost kind of not really hairy, but a little bit. They have a spear and they have kind of a, you know, elongated forehead or a big jaw or something like that. But how can we really know? How close can we get, do you think, in terms of accuracy?
Right. Well, I actually did a video, very rough, I have to say, and put on YouTube about Neanderthals and basically what they look like. And part of it, I was critiquing this idea of reconstructing for so-called forensic reconstructions of Neanderthals based on their skeletons. And I made that critique on a few bases. First of all, that when they take a Neanderthal skull and they start wrapping the clay around it to create a face and reconstruct the face, they're basically using the same dimensions, thicknesses of the skin as humans. So they're assuming that it's a human. And so, of course, you end up with, when you wrap a plasticine or a matrix, either a computer screen or a physical matrix around a skeleton, you end up with something that looks like a human, because you're putting in human-shaped eyes, even though the orbits, the eye sockets, are 20% bigger. But if you put in human eyes, then you just fill it with stuff. There's no nose, there's no bone for the nose, but you put in a protruding nose, you're putting full lips because humans have full lips. But these are soft tissue features that are not preserved in the fossil record. So you don't know what they look like. It's just guessing. And I argue that if you took a chimpanzee skull or a gorilla skull and wrapped and used the same human dimensions and skin textures, then you would end up with something that looked very different to a chimpanzee or gorilla. There's a monkey called the proboscis monkey, which has a huge pendulous nose. Well, if you didn't know what the nose looked like, you certainly can't tell from the skull. It's just got a hole in the skull. So my point is that these reconstructions are very suspect, and they're basically bad science. Like some of them, the anthropomorphism is so acute. There's one in baby Neanderthal in a museum. I think it's in Germany. It's actually got nappies on, or what you'd call diapers. The idea that Neanderthals 100,000 years ago wrapping their little babies in nappies or diapers is just ludicrous. The women are always shown with protuberant breasts, even though not one other species of primate has protuberant breasts. My point is that when you want to reconstruct what they look like, I ended up taking a very different thing of looking at the evidence and a cold climate adapted thing, creature, and I ended up commissioning what I found as the world's best digital sculptor, a guy in Spain, and to reconstruct it, and we ended up with something that looked very different. And I've put those in my book and on the website, and I've given them out to put them out for free so people can use them. But it's a very different thing. It's not the smooth skin kind of hairless, good-looking creature that we have today.
Why do you think it is that we have anthropomorphized the Neanderthals? As you said, I mean, the relationship we have with them today is that they were, you know, basically like our cousin or something like that. And again, this mystery of, well, why did they just disappear is obviously, you know, gleaming right in our face there. But why this tendency to kind of humanize them, if you will?
Why is the tendency to humanize them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just part of human nature. You know, if you look at cartoons, you know, you've got this kind of thing going way back, and I've cited evidence that you have things from the Sphinx, that you have creatures in Egyptian mythology that are half hawk, half human. We have this thing, it's just part of what we are and what we do. Cartoons, we have monkeys dressed up in suits, and we have birds that talk, and it's just what we do, and we extend that to Neanderthals, and that's fine for normal people, but you would expect more from scientists. You would expect them to be a bit more impartial and objective about these forensic reconstructions.
Indeed. Now, don't know if you heard about this. This was a couple of months ago now. Professor George Church of Harvard Medical School actually believes that he can reconstruct Neanderthal DNA. And, you know, this has been kind of sensationalized, of course, but, you know, effectively resurrect the species pretty much. He's like looking at cloning and things like that. Do you think that there, something like that ever would be possible?
Yeah. It's interesting with the Neanderthal DNA. It probably in the future, it'll almost definitely be possible. I keep meaning to send him a copy of the book and say you might be able to do it.
Is it a good idea?
Yeah,
exactly.
Whether you want to do it.
That's my point.
The trouble with the DNA, of course, is archaic DNA. It just kind of splinters up into little bits, and it's very difficult to get long strands that are perfect. You know, and you only need to make. I mean, genes are so complex and so interconnected that you only need to be a few nucleotides out in a couple of genes, and you can end up with something very different. You know, considering that we share most of this, mice and humans have pretty well the same genes and the same configurations.
Well, let me ask you, if we proceed a little bit kind of on that line as well. Obviously, the idea that it would be not, you know, too smart to do something like that, but if we kind of move on that for a little bit from what our image are of the Neanderthals and talk about, you know, how we've developed to what we are today. There's some of the properties that we have, and I want to kind of get your take on why this has been important in the past. Art is, of course, a big one. We have you bring up a couple of examples in the book as well of the Lascaux Caves. There is one going back to about 70,000 years, I believe, actually, somewhere in Africa, basically the oldest worship believed to be of a python snake or something like that. But how was art something that was beneficial to our survival way, way, way back then?
Good question. The thing about art is it only actually appeared in cave walls about 30,000 years ago. Now, that really puzzled me. It's because we were made the shift from Middle Paleolithic, artless, to Upper Paleolithic, full of art and culture, tool making and carving ivory and other complex bone things, 47,000 years ago. So there's a huge gap. And then suddenly, I mean, not suddenly, but part of the theory argues that the first priority of art, the first adaptive function of art and creativity and imagination was not decoration, was not painting, was not carving of tusks and bone. It was to produce weapons. That's where the adaptive functionality of creativity lay. And the idea that if humans could invent something, a sling or a bow or a super light javelin with very small projectile tips, and to half that with proper glue, and so that you're able to find the recipe for the resin to make sure the tip didn't come off. These require creativity. They're not something that's evident at all in the Middle Paleolithic. You don't see any of that. So my point is that that was the function of imagination. The painting and the decoration came 15,000 years later, 18,000 years later. It was only then that we start seeing evidence of people painting their caves.
Yeah, so it's a long gap in between there. How is it with art then? If we look at the depiction, I would think we have a really weird creature, of course, showing up in a lot of the art that's depicted around the world, these kind of weird bug-eyed, you know, creatures, huge heads and things like that. But would you think that there would be more depictions of the Neanderthal on these cave walls and stuff like that if this immense predator kind of relationship was going on at that time?
Yeah, well, I've looked at that quite closely, and there are examples of creatures. In fact, the earliest known sculpture, the earliest known carved thing, is a lion from Germany. It's called the Lion Man, and it's called a lion man, but it's half human, and it's got the head of some kind of creature, and to my mind, it could well be a Neanderthal creature. It's got very thick, stocky legs. And a great head, kind of flat head with low brow ridges that could well be a Neanderthal. So there are these kind of creatures in early art and in cave paintings, and they're certainly in the earliest mythology where you start to get early Greek and monsters that are kind of coming down to devour people. So, you know, there is a tradition that's gone on since the late Paleolithic or the Neolithic, certainly from there and onwards.
How recent do you think that there were Neanderthals around? Do you think that there could have been few scattered, across in different regions? You mentioned, of course, the Gibraltar area, that might be one of the last places where they actually were at. But do you think it's possible that some smaller groups here and there actually survived, you know, many, many thousand years after we see them disappear from the record pretty much?
Yes, I think that's definitely possible. But notwithstanding that you had these humans who were, as I say, like determined and purpose-built kind of Neanderthal hunters, they were, you know, if there were any around and they got the sniff of any, they would certainly eventually chase them down, and they'd marshal considerable forces by then, the first armies and the first kind of proto-armies to hunt them down. But what I believe happened is that the Neanderthals would have retreated, particularly in Europe. In the Levant, they will wipe that pretty cleanly and quickly. But in Europe, I think they some of them went into the higher grounds up into the Alps. And so I'm kind of confident, or not confident, I'm hopeful that with the, not that one wants to see the ice caps melting, but with the snow melting in regions of the Alps, that we might end up finding a frozen Neanderthal, and that would solve all the problems. It would kind of resolve everything. We'd know exactly what they look like as the Tyrolean Itzi, or whatever it's called, was discovered. So, you know, I'm hopeful that there might be some evidence. But yes, certainly they certainly were strong, resilient creatures, and they were, you know, they were as far afield as Russia, and some even were thought to have gone to almost to Asia. So they were widely dispersed.
Now, there's also been a kind of debate as to their intelligence and everything else. And obviously, if we're talking about us being in a point of immense evolution fairly quickly as well, something I'm going to ask you later about, but at the start of it, if we can look at it that way, when we were basically, you know, middle Paleolithic before we went to upper, do you think that they were smarter than us, Neanderthals, at that stage?
Well, the way evolution works is that you end up being as smart as you need to be to survive. And what we do know is that they were a social hunter, like lions who hunt in packs. And, for example, there's one case in Europe where Neanderthals herded a group of horses over a cliff and killed them. So that they obviously hunted in packs, and they were extremely formidable as pack hunters. So they had that kind of cunning, and they obviously had communications to support that kind of hunting. It wasn't necessarily a kind of cogent language like ours, but they certainly would have had very sophisticated languages enough to support that kind of hunting and social systems.
So do you think that we developed language pretty much for the reasons of strategy of how to, maneuver away the Neanderthals, and this is the prime incentive, if you will, for us to really, really develop our language skills?
Yes. Yes, I have a suite of what I call strategic adaptations. These are adaptations that weren't just defensive, they were offensive. And language was one of the most important ones, because language allowed us to plan battle sequences, to construct strategies, to talk about going around the back, cutting them off at the pass, these kind of things. Language is a strategic adaptation. There's nothing more strategic than language for humans, those humans. So it would have created an enormous selection pressure for humans to develop language, to develop forward thinking, reasoning, logic, these kind of strategies that we still use in battle situations today.
Yeah, very important. It's very interesting. Now, what do you think about how many you have a portion of this in the book, it's pretty interesting. Basically, we're talking about, macro evolution and how many generations, speculative here, it takes to actually transform, if you will, almost one species into something else. When this evolutionary event occurs, it seems like it's in the record. It's overnight, pretty much. But I think in your calculations is around 4,000 generations or so. Is that enough time to make a macro evolutionary thing to occur, basically?
Well, it's not possible in a very, very large population, but when you've got a very small population, it's completely feasible. So if you've got one tribe, basically one population, and they're interbreeding, then you're going to get all sorts of wonderful things happening. But whereas the problem with normal evolution is it has to filter through the whole population until it becomes what's called fixed. And if you've got a population spread across a vast area, it's much more difficult, and the adaptation has to be very, very, very important. But basically the qualities that I'm saying that were strategic adaptations, they included male aggression, courage, self-sacrifice. And self-sacrifice is an interesting one, because the idea that humans can lay down their lives and be so brave that they could attempt to to attack an enemy, you know, the fact that humans go to war when there's a very good chance of getting killed is so counterintuitive, it's so anti-evolutionary, it's so maladaptive, it almost takes your breath away. It has no adaptive functionality except in the pursuit and engagement of Neanderthals. That's when that kind of self-sacrifice, that kind of courage, it can provide the turning point and make the difference between winning and losing. So that kind of sacrifice was adaptive, tough-minded, being able to kill Neanderthals without compunction. Another one is what I call Machiavellian intelligence, and that's the kind of intelligence to be scheming, to be duplicitous, to be sneaky, and to do all the kind of things that you need to do to get a strategic advantage. Language and creativity I've mentioned. Another one is organization, and that's the origins of human society, and that's the ability to organize ourselves into cogent proto-armies, to have hierarchies, to have males that give orders and for others to follow them, and to organize ourselves into soldiers and support people. The other one is gender differences. So you have the males who were taking the fight to the Neanderthals had to be supported. They had to have women who maintained the home fires. They had to nurture the young, support, provide food, and make spears and arrows and stuff. And today, one of the few differences between human males and human females is that human females have a greater physical dexterity with their hands. And I think this was to do with making weapons and stuff.
Hmm.
And this also gets into the division of labor, so that that anything that supported human males doing the fighting was beneficial. So this demarcation of labor is very, very important.
So the different roles have arisen for a reason, and the primary reason, again, was survival, to be able to make it.
Yes, yes. I mean, the other thing, it had an enormous effect on, basically, it invented patriarchy. And by that I mean, you know, there's this thing that feminists have been talking about rightly for many, many years, and that is this kind of enigma, this anomaly of men's preoccupation with the control of women's sexuality and their control of women. And this goes back, I believe, to this interaction where it was very important for men to prevent their females from interacting with Neanderthals, particularly sexually, and fearing female sexuality because it attracted Neanderthals. So you have this fear creeping into human sexuality. And, you know, today we take it for granted. We have men being jealous, and you have cases of morbid jealousy where males kill or injure females, or acid attacks, or these terrible things of prescribing women's sexuality and containing it and forcing them to wear clothes and veils and enforce modesty and frowning on anything like that, and permissiveness. It's not so bad for males to have to be permissive, but it's very frowned on for females to be permissive.
Sure.
So
yep.
this patriarchy, I believe, can be traced straight back to this kind of horrific fear and trauma that males felt of having the threat of having their females taken by Neanderthals and trying to protect them as a resource, and particularly because without females there is no species. So there's, from an evolutionary perspective, there's an enormous imperative to maintain that breeding population and to maintain it within reach and out of reach of Neanderthals.
Very interesting. I mean, these are traits, obviously, then, as a consequence, that we are struggling with even today, as you said, although that there's been a shift towards another type of set of behaviors, it's still very much there. But it's a double-edged sword. That's what I want to talk a little bit next about here. The comeback, if you will, that we make, or, you know, the humans at that time makes is remarkable, from being decimated into very few, then actually coming back into the game, quote unquote, here, if you will. So on one hand, it's a remarkable feat in terms of survival to be able to turn the tables on this. But at the same time, as you've been describing, it also produces this incredibly another kind of predatory species, which is highly violent and incredibly ferocious in its own way. And this is some of the traits still that we're dealing with today. The question is, now when we don't have this threat on this level anymore, it's kind of gone. Is it a situation where basically where we don't use it, we lose it, if you will, if we don't have an incentive to try to progress further, to become smarter, etc., what have you, there's no predator there, if you will. can we end up in a situation where we actually again begins to go backward, revert back? Is that possible, you think, Danny?
Well, that for me is the $64,000 question. It's a very pertinent question, and it's one that I've thought a lot about, and unfortunately I feel a bit pessimistic, and that's simply because there are so many genes that were dependent on and derived from this prolonged period of predation. We're talking 50,000 years, that's thousands and thousands of generations. So it is deep, deep within our psyche, and particularly for men, it's deeper in for men. So it's not so that women, I think, if you look at women, they are behaviorally a bit more like we were before the predation, but men bore the brunt of it. So this aggression, it can lie dormant, and you can have periods of great peace and tranquility and cooperation between states and villages and towns and countries. But then, under the circumstances, when you get these subliminally perceived indicators of Neanderthal activity, it creates what I call being primed. Humans become primed. And once they're subliminally alert to these indicators and they start to see signs of Neanderthal activity, it can cause all sorts of things. It can be a cause of depression. It can be a cause of anxiety. It can be a cause of sleeplessness and nightmares. And in fact, some of your listeners will have nightmares because of just simply listening to this interview. They won't know about it, but in the next few days, I've seen people who they say, "Oh, I'm terrified. I didn't sleep after listening to that," because it taps into this stuff. But when these triggers are alerted, mm-hmm. then it, and some politicians, to their disgrace, are subconsciously, intuitively aware of how to do this. They know how to create them and us mindsets. And for me, the them and us mindsets are the most dangerous threat to humanity and to the future of the planet. You know, people like Hitler, who was able to, say, provide a model of us as Aryans and them as Jews and homosexuals and gypsies and other minorities, and invite people to treat these minorities as if they were Neanderthals and to move to horrific, fatal genocidal solutions that can be somehow supported by some thin rationality of sorts that whatever it is, you know, put forward that to sustain these deep, deep kind of prejudices we have against Neanderthals, not against Jews or homosexuals or anything, but you know, it's using these as an analog, very sadly.
Do you think it could be a situation also then that we, when there isn't one to another species to hunt, we turn on each other effectively and we make these divisions within our own race pretty much, and that's what we're kind of stuck with right now? I mean, earlier you said, Danny, that you believe that the most violent of these humans who made it way back then, they kind of died out and everything, but surely if their DNA lives on to a certain extent, are there properties of them encoded into our non-coding DNA at this point still?
Oh, absolutely. You know, what, you know, we as a species are, you know, I have to laugh because we're called Homo sapiens, which means wise man. Right. And, you know, I think of humans as Homo virulence. You know, we are a virulent species. We are kind of nasty and warlike and genocidal, and we can be, particularly the males, there's a distinction between females and males, but as a gender thing, males are kind of horrific, and we carry that, and it's the only thing I think as a moderating force is for education to play a part in terms of early on, for people to be aware and to be taught as children. This is the legacy that we humans are dealt with. We are, particularly the boys, need to be shown that, yes, when you're 16 or 17, you will start to get into extreme risk-taking behavior. That was adaptive back then because that's when you were called on to first fight the Neanderthals. But mm-hmm. in terms of today, you have to be aware that your propensity to enlist in armies, to volunteer for to go off to battle is not productive, is not adaptive, is not commonsensical, is not right. You know, but the thought of these of young guys going off to fight, it's tragic. And if people were kind of taught somehow that, yes, it's based on this antiquated kind of system of a war that went on 50,000 years ago and is now there's no evolutionary imperative for any longer, they might be less willing to go off and sacrifice themselves on the kind of altar of male aggression.
Well, what do you feel then when you think about things that separate us from other animals on this planet? You mentioned romance and love before, the use of fragrance or perfume to, you know, to hide our scent, getting off hair from our body, you know, the obsession with shaving and everything else, so even to pottery and cooking. All of this then is basically a consequence of us being predated on, and we're trying to turn this around. So how do you view those things today when you think about it? It's like, is it unnatural in a way, or is it all good, all part of, you know, just the experience that we're having right now as humans?
Well, I see it as a kind of sad consequence. I mean, but, you know, it's also Neanderthal predation has given us the intellect with which to create all the wonderful things that we have, our creativity, our intelligence and that. So it's a mixed bag. Basically, we do have these dark satanic forces that are rampaging, these urges to separate people into them and us and to kill them. And we have it with each other. So it's a two-way sword. You can give, and we have a propensity to be racist, to differentiate people on the color of their skin, on the shape of their face, their eyes, whatever. You know, and these are all sad, tragic legacies of that predation. But, you know, equally we have creativity, and we have the Mona Lisa, and we have kind of great art and culture as a consequence too. So it's a mixed bag.
Do you ultimately think that awareness to become, because to a large extent right now, then if this is a theory that is correct, then let's say a lot of this is hinged on the fact that we have a kind of a cultural memory or genetic memory. It's coded into us. We talked about how this has been incorporated into films and stories, mythology, etc. before, so it's kind of it resonates something within us when we see these things. When this image of this monster again is kind of re-erected, if you will. But the first step towards beginning to understanding something like this, that we've been subjected to this, must be awareness, to bring it to your conscious mind first, to actually be able to maybe, I guess, halt our own behavior before we fall into a pattern of a reaction, or like a reflex, if you will, if you're understanding what I'm getting at.
Yes, no, I agree. I think awareness is absolutely fundamental to the whole thing. And that's why, like, say, for me, from my perspective, when I see young men enlisting voluntarily to go off to a war where there's a good chance of getting them killed, it makes no sense at all. I'm completely opposed to it. And I'm hoping that if team theory, if Neanderthal predation theory becomes widespread and young people read it, they might finally kind of say, oh, okay, that's what it's about. Oh, well, I'll choose not to go off and enlist. You know, maybe that might happen, and that would be a wonderful thing and a step towards peace. But, yes, no, I think the first step is for people to be aware. Like, because I've been living with this theory for a while, and I see its implications, and I see its manifestations almost every day of how, you know, even, like, for example, when you turn on the news to see if there's any activity of Neanderthals. That's the fear that drives it. Mm-hmm. What you want to gossip because you want to know, are they around? You know, these are all natural reactions to a long, prolonged period of being predated. Depression, I think, is also, you have a sense of this underlying dread that these creatures are around, that they're in the vicinity. You know, they're so deeply, deeply ingrained into our consciousness. And that's the good thing about team theory, which is the master theory that it explains how those emotional propensities and feelings and sensations got inside our genes.
Indeed. Now, we have a lot of people actually taking advantage of these properties in humans as well. We've had wars being fought over this. We've had, you know, religions created and allegiances with different groupings and things like that. And it seems like there is a kind of a senselessness, although that this is supposedly we've developed an intelligence so that we were be able to defeat this, you know, threat, the Neanderthals. But it's still at the same time, it seems to be detrimental to us at the end of the day, because we become gullible to a certain extent, right? So it's kind of an oxymoron there.
Yeah. You know, there's two things here. One is that our reaction to Neanderthals and to Neanderthal predation is essentially an emotional one. So, and that's quite separate from our rational thing. So you can have an emotional reaction, and you can have an intellectual reaction. For example, you know, people might have an emotional reaction against gay marriage. That's an issue in Australia at the moment, whether gays should be married. And you could have an emotional issue about that, a visceral reaction, and then you can have an intelligent, rational reaction. And they can be quite separate. They can be quite different. So, you know, in the case of Neanderthals, it's important to use rationality and logic and intellect. These are the supreme attributes of humans. These are what control and negate these base forces, these base instincts. And we have to use them, and we have to keep, politicians and citizens have to keep in mind that when they have these feelings, that there are rational overriders that can assuage and control and negate these basic instincts.
Very good. Now, so we begin to wrap things up here for this time then, Danny. Do you think there will be any more archaeological discoveries coming out here in the next few years? Or is there anything that you're even aware of, maybe studies that are ongoing that might further bring evidence to the forefront of supporting this theory?
Well, you know, I've been lucky so far. I've argued that Neanderthals were these cannibalistic species. That's been shown in the evidence that they ate meat. That's been shown in the evidence that they mated with humans. That's all been shown. So I'm pretty happy. The one thing I would like is to discover soft tissue remains of a Neanderthal, hopefully frozen in the Alps, and that would show what their soft tissues look like.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Something that the fossil record can't show us.
That's right. What are you working on next here, Danny? You're moving on, of course. Anything else you have in the pipeline coming up?
Yes, well, like for 12 years I've been writing this, the Magnus Opus. This is the main team theory, which is, I think, an important work. And I've got a few chapters to go, and I've hoped to finish it this year and get it published next year. So that's the major work. And after that, I've got another book which I'm writing on the evolution of God, which looks at it's why, how, and humans believe in gods.
Interesting thing. Is it related to this theory?
Well, it's related to team theory. It's derived from team theory. It explores why, you know, there are human. What I'm interested in is things that are universal in humans, human nature, things. Like humans all around the world, irrespective of culture and race, appear to believe in some supernatural being. That's not everybody does, but there is a tendency. They also have a tendency to make sacrifice. Sacrifice is also common. There's also another one of pilgrimage, where we tend to have this innate need to make pilgrimage. And so I'm looking at all these in a kind of unified theory to try and explain how, why, and when we started to believe in God or gods.
All right, very good. Maybe that's something we'll get a chance to discuss at another time, but for today here, we'll begin to wrap things up. Danny, please give us the websites again so people know where to go to follow your work and also pick up copies of the book if they want to read more and continue on this path here.
Okay, thank you. It's www.themandus, all one word, .org. That's for Neanderthal predation theory, and for the big work, the team theory, that's thesecondevolution.com.
All right, very good. We're going to have these links up on our website as well. Well, thank you for your time today, Danny. Really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on. I hope you enjoyed it as well.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much, Henrik, and thank you for having me. Great.
Okay, that's our program for today. We hope you have some new ideas to think about and consider. Thank you for listening. As usual, we'll return in just a few days with Scott Volter, and you'll find our full list of upcoming guests in our radio archive. Have a great day, and we will talk to you in just a few. Bye-bye.